Folks, if you'd like a copy of my best-selling first book, Tales of a First Round Nothing, head on over to ecwpress.com. If you'd like a copy of my second book, Tales with TR, Fights, Film, and Folklore, head on over to www.flankerpress.com. If you'd like either copy personalized, just add a note. Thanks for listening to my podcast, and happy reading.
You're listening to the Hockey Podcast Network. New shows every day. Find us at thehockeypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Hello! Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to episode 195B of Tales with TR. Let's get right to it. We don't have a lot of time and we got a great guest. So, ladies and gentlemen, my next guest starred for the New Jersey Rockets and Thayer Academy All-Stars before being drafted in the first round, eighth overall, by the Chicago Blackhawks in the 1988 NHL Entry Draft. After a short, sweet stint in the QMJHL with the Hall Olympique, he'd hit the ground running in the NHL and never looked back. His career spanned two decades, and with that, he'd produce over 500 goals, over 1,200 points, and also tack on almost 1,500 penalty minutes. Always outspoken, this Hall of Fame-worthy Pepper Pot became only the third player in Blackhawks history to snipe 50 goals in a season, and his accolades are too numerous to count. Some highlights include 9 NHL All-Star Games, 300-point seasons, and a place in the United States of America Hockey Hall of Fame as undoubtedly one of the best American players to ever lace up skates. He is a sharp shooter, heavy hitter, tantalizing talker, a fantastic forward, a proud player, an amazing American. The kid could play. He's from Boston, USA. He's tough like John Wick and was a first-round pick. He played with no fear during his illustrious career. Crops need rain, and this guy played through pain. Bob Barker knew the price, and he scored 50 twice. Humpty Dumpty took a great fall, and this dude should be in the hall. He's got a cool nickname and is a true legend of the game. They call him JR, and he drives a nice card. Folks, I'm a bad magician because I don't know a trick. And please welcome to the show, it's Jeremy Roenick. JR, how the fuck are you?
That by far was the best intro of all time. I was totally proud of myself, but totally entertained. That was awesome.
Well, if anybody's easy to write for, you are. Not only did I follow your career, a lot of it I didn't even have to research. Coming a little bit after you, actually. We have eighth overall in common. It ends there. But I had your passion for the game. I know we share
That is for sure. And passion for life, too. You have an amazing passion for life and your friends, which is amazing.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother. Yeah.
I see. I was just curious there. Okay. First time I met you, you were playing. Me and a bunch of noofs were living in Calgary, and we went to see you were playing with San Jose with our buddy Ryan Clough. Yeah. And you didn't know me from Adam, and I never said but you sat at our table, and we told stories the whole time, and you hung with all the noofs. Claude Lemieux was there. Yeah. I know that. And he only played like 12 games with you guys, but it was that. Maybe it was 08-09 in any case.
Yeah, it was 08-09. It was a lot of fun. I remember that night. There's no question. Ryan Clough is one of my favorite teammates of all time. Absolutely special, special guy. And a tough son of a bitch too. That boy could play, and he was not afraid to drop the gloves and scrap it out. And always will be one of my favorite teammates of all time.
That's awesome. He was a late bloomer. Like he left here at like 18 and played like junior B, and then like made it onto Rimouski, and like you couldn't hold the guy down. And I think he was a year late in the draft, like 19, and he went sixth round, but just kept improving. And he was like Bambi on skates, right? But we could always tell he had the hands. It was like this guy, when he fills in, and that was just skating with him in the summer. And did he ever fill in, man? He began his career cut a little bit short because of concussions, but I still say one of, definitely one of, there'd be an argument if his career came to fruition like it should have. There's an argument he's the best Newfoundlander ever. But anyway, up there with Danny Cleary, Michael Ryder, Alex Newhook. I mean, who do you? It's all subjective, right? It's all fucking subjective.
Danny Cleary, another friend of mine who was actually
great guy.
Who was actually the pick, the number one first round draft pick of the trade that took me from Chicago. First round pick. That was Danny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Craig Mills is a buddy of ours. He played with Millsy in Belleville, right? I knew the boys because Millsy used to come over in the summer. So I knew that. Yeah. For him, because Millsy was in that trade, why I
said. Craig Mills was in that trade, a first round draft pick and a second round draft pick. But that was,
I didn't realize Dan the Man ended up being that guy. Yeah. Well, I mean, he's definitely the most accomplished.
That turns out to be a turns out to be a great trade for the Newfies. You know, I got traded twice for two Newfies.
And shout out one more teammate of mine that's not a Newfoundlander, but he might as well be. That's one of my favorite ever, Bird Dog, Greg Smith. Yeah. And I said, everybody who played with Greg, with Bird Dog, either he made an impression one way or the other, but they remember
God rest his soul, man. One of the greatest teammates of all time.
Yeah, just unfucking believable. I told you we went to the bar when he died and he had a tab there for us.
I actually had the privilege to chat with him before he passed, and I did. And I got him in the last week, maybe in the last couple of days, and it was special to me because Bird Dog fought for me many times, and he was one of my favorites in the locker room, and he was a card playing opponent that showed me a lot of passion playing cards and playing, which always had a lot of laughs, but not many players love the game like Bird Dog. And to be able to speak with him before he passed was a special thing for me.
That's awesome. He made his home over here and was just a great dude, like rubber boots. And he looked like a Newfoundlander, acted like a Newfoundlander. We would be getting paid like hundreds of dollars a game to play senior, more towards 1,000 than zero. And he played the whole year for lumber and moose meat.
Some people don't need a lot to live. You know that, T? Not.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like you said, passion for life. But I got to go back to the beginning here because from being in the car with you and trying to track you, we rode in the car together in Moncton and you told me a little bit of your story. And not everything's on HockeyDB or Wikipedia. So you moved around. I believe your parents, I know you played for the New Jersey Rockets, but you didn't live in New Jersey, right? Like just take me there.
At 10 years old, I moved down to Virginia. My dad was a high exec in Mobil Oil. So we moved to Virginia where the regional offices were for Mobil. And I started playing for a team called the Washington Metros, and we turned it into the Washington Junior Capitals. And had two really good seasons with the Junior Capitals in my 11th age year. And then in my 12th and 13th, there's a team that we played against in the same division in New Jersey, the New Jersey Rockets. And we got to be friends with a couple of parents up there, and they had probably one of the best teams in the East Coast. And they invited myself and my very close friend on the team in Washington. His name was Matt Mulgrave. He got drafted by Toronto back in 88 also. Ended up not playing for the team. He went to St. John's and then quit St. John's after 2 years. He was a Harvard grad and just went on to make tens of millions of dollars in the financial world. But anyway, Matt Mulgrave and I would go up to New Jersey, and I'd fly there every Friday. My mom would take me out of school at like 2 o'clock, take me to the airport, Dulles Airport, pop me on a People's Express plane. And I would fly up to Newark Airport where another family would pick me up every Friday, and I'd stay at their house. And then we would either play games at home or we'd get in the car and travel all over the East Coast, whether it was Boston, New York, Buffalo, even heading up into Canada. So it was well worth the while because we won a national championship that year. And then I stayed on the team one more year after I moved up to Boston to go to school. And we won a national championship again. So two back-to-back national Bantam championships we won in New Jersey by taking a lot of sacrifice and a lot of miles in a car, a lot of miles in a plane. And but that's what you do when you're a kid, right? Yeah, that's the most fun time in your life.
Yeah. Wow, that's wild. Interesting. That's a huge sacrifice. Yeah. Now, listen, you're winning the Bantam Nationals. I know U.S. is big, but had you come across Mike Modano at that point? I only say it because I know you guys were peas in a pod. You came up. There's a big history going all the way back. You're two of the top-rated guys from the United States. He goes one overall. You go eight. But back then, you must have heard of him or like in Bantam, you must have come across him or you must have beat him, I guess, or someone that beat
him. Yeah, well, that's when I first learned of Mike Modano during that stretch as a Bantam. He was from Livonia, Michigan, and I believe he was either played for CompuWare or Little Caesars. I mean, I could be wrong, but...
No, I think it's Little Caesars.
Yeah, Little Caesars.
I believe.
We actually beat CompuWare in the second national championship final. And I think we definitely beat Little Caesars, on our way to two championships. But it was always Mike Modano and I as the... You know, the comparison of who was the number one U.S. player at that age and moving on up through the 16, 17, even, the juniors. And, Mike ended up going to Prince Albert. He decided to go the world junior, the major junior route, which was very surprising to a lot of us because there's a lot of really great hockey in prep school. And I guess there's probably not a lot there in Michigan as high school comes. So he decided to go major junior. I stayed in the prep school ranks and decided to try my luck playing high school hockey, which was definitely a much higher level of play than what you could play at say, the midget AAA. So it worked out pretty well for me.
Now, were there teams, because you're in prep school, that were hesitant because, there's not much. What are you going to do? Get 800 points? Like, at some point, you're going to be the most dominant player, and you were. But were there, you went eighth. So I guess there weren't too many teams, but like, was that even Chicago, were they confident or were they like, okay, like,
no, they weren't confident.
Like, cause at some point you went to Hull and I don't even understand that. Cause when I look at your stats, you got a point a game in the 20 games in the NHL that year. So I guess
it was kind of strange because at that time in the '80s, it was unheard of for an NHL team to take any US high school kids. I think I was the fourth player and maybe the last player from U.S. high school to be drafted by the National Hockey League in the first round and immediately joining the National Hockey League, like right after the draft. I don't think anybody.
I only know Tom Barrasso.
Well, Tom Barrasso is one of them. Bobby Carpenter is one of them. And Phil Housley's another. So
okay, I didn't know that.
So the four of us, and Tommy Peterson might have done it right after me, but I don't. I think Tommy Peterson went someplace else. He was a Minnesota kid, but it just didn't happen back in the '80s, right? NHL didn't draft high school kids, especially kids that were 150 pounds.
It's five levels up, man. It's insane.
Yeah, so I was 150 pounds in 1988. Come June, which is the draft.
Whoa!
So
150.
Yeah. And at the draft, I wouldn't step on a scale. I wouldn't take off my clothes so they could see what kind of body mass I had. I just wouldn't do that for anybody. So what was the kicker for Chicago? There was a gentleman named Sean Cody, who was the scout in the United States, a scout in New England, who scouted me in my prep school years. And there was another guy, the head scout of Chicago's name was Jack Davison. These are the two guys that were very, very high on me. And come right before the draft, like literally the morning of the draft, and they're having their last meetings before they go to the arena. Jack Davison and Sean Cody said to Bob Pulford, the GM, we need to draft Roenick number eight. And that's he is our pick. And if you don't pick him number eight, we quit. We're going to throw in our resignation.
Ooh, yikes.
And Jack Davison had a tremendous reputation in the league. He was one of the best. He's been with Chicago for a long time.
And, I remember
and
that.
For him to really put his neck on the line for me was saying something. So that was enough for Bob Pulford and Mike Keenan to draft me because two very, very special scouts put their careers on the line for me. And when I showed up at camp 4 months later, I actually made the team, but didn't score any points in the first four games. So Keenan says, listen, we need to get you with a little bit different players, let you, get a little bit stronger, a little faster, play against some top players. like junior. I mean, I was only 158 pounds when I went to Chicago, but I played four games, no points. So Keenan gave me the option to either go to Hull or go to Sault Ste. Marie. Both had drafted me in late rounds. So I decided to go to Hull because I was more comfortable in the Quebec League. It was an offensive league. I knew it better. And I went there for 3 months until the World Juniors, and I just tore apart the league. You know, at like 28 games, I had 74 points or something like that. Yeah. And played in the World Juniors, set a U.S. record in points in the World Juniors. Came back game one back in Hull, hurt my knee. And then I was out the whole month of January. Then February 13th, I got an emergency call up from the Hawks. They had too many injuries. They couldn't bring people up from the minors. So they used an emergency recall situation to bring me up from Hull, where I went into Minnesota, scored my first game, then scored my second game, third game, and ended up staying 20 games on this emergency recall and had like had 18 points in the 20 games after I left.
Yeah.
And stayed the rest of the time.
Okay. No name bar, too, for your first night.
First goal, no name bar. Nobody knew who I was. I think I'm the only player in the history.
Right? Even the people in the rink didn't know.
When you don't have the technology to put a nameplate on the back of a shirt back in 1988, you know, or in 89, you know, that's pretty bad.
Well, that must have been, even for a junior showing up, that must have been funny. But how did you play both playoffs? I've never heard of that. Or did I misread that you played Hull in the playoffs and Chicago in the playoffs?
Because Hull playoffs started before.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it started before. Of course. And unfortunately, we got knocked out in Hull in the second round unexpectedly. We had an amazing team. We got upset, I think, by Victoriaville in the second round. And it was just as the second round, I think, was starting for the Hawks against St. Louis. And I jumped right from the Hull playoffs right into the NHL playoffs, where I scored my first NHL playoff goal against St. Louis Blues after getting my teeth knocked out by Glenn Featherstone within the same period.
Fuck, dude. Now, first of all, you got 7 penalty minutes. Was there a fight there? Or did you get a cross-check?
Yeah, I went up against Glenn Featherstone, and I got, I think, 2 for roughing and 2 for cross-checking or slashing or something. He got five minutes for high-sticking, and the game is
that was that play.
Yeah.
So, JR, look, I know, I don't know how many times, but a lot of highlights I remember, you're stitching yourself up, coming back with a cage on, taking teeth out of your mouth.
No,
I remember you told one story about a lady in the front row that passed out looking at you.
Never a cage. I wouldn't put a cage on. I broke my nose 9 times. I wouldn't wear a cage. I wore a cage 1 time. That's when I broke my jaw in 5 places against.
Oh, the white thing. That wasn't even really a cage.
No, that was just protection. Like that was 16 days after Darrin Hatcher demolished my jaw in 6 places. And I came back to play. I came back to play in the playoffs, totally wired up. And they put that on.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. So all that, I mean, how many, you got hundreds of stitches in your face,
hundreds,
I would assume.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And then, you know, broken nose 9 times. And it's just, you know, but I never wore a mask. I never wore a face, a mouthpiece. It was just that time. It was that kind of hockey back then. You know, it was macho hockey. It was tough hockey. You didn't want to show any kind of weakness to anybody. So that's how I played.
I came from the other, like, you know, again, I, you know, again, didn't play as long as you but I did play hard, and I played 5 or 6 years pro. I never put a visor. I remember going from junior, when I took off the visor in Montreal, I was like, whoa, I'm seeing the ice way better. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't put it, like, I just feel like free. I feel like if peripheral vision is part of what I do, I'd rather have, you know, maximize my potential. I couldn't think of wearing it. Now, of course, I didn't get 5 slap shots in the face, but still, I admire you for it.
Listen,
you came back from a lot of injuries.
I always said, I don't know any player that uses their face to play the game. I mean,
I know.
I mean, if it gets broken, it gets broken again. It'll heal. It's all right. It's, for me, it was winning was more important to me.
I love that. Well, that's evident. Yeah, good teammate. Great teammate. Why number 27?
I don't know. I think I want to believe it was one of the Sutter brothers that wore 27 in Chicago before I got there, and he had just left, so it was vacant. And they just had that number in the road bag. They brought it out and put it on me, and they just never.
I see. Okay, I thought it was superstition. So I'm in Montreal, and guy, this was 96, 97, I guess. I was there for four games. They had me all year, and they sent me back at the deadline to Red Deer. They wanted me to practice with the team and learn from some of the older guys. And one of the older guys was Dave Manson. And this guy came in, and I know he hurt his throat or whatever, so he would always have this crazy, like, presence of authority, because he sounded like, I don't know, like a villain in a movie or something. And he wore these tiny shoulder pads, which I remember I went to hit him in practice. I'm like, whoa. And he's like, yeah, I barely wear any pads. It's a harder hit. And I'm like, and I took that advice, you know, because sometimes you hit someone with barely anything on and it hurts way more. You get way more because there's no absorption.
He learned that from Chris Chelios in Chicago, because I played with Dave for 8 years in Chicago.
I was going to say, I knew you played with him three or four. I didn't realize that time.
Maybe 7 years I played with Dave, and he was a beast of a man. If you ever get a chance to go on YouTube, and you have to type in the St. Patrick's Day Massacre.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
That was an unbelievable game between St. Louis and Chicago. It was a melee, and Dave Manson and Scott Stevens went from the corner of the ice and skated to center ice, right in center ice circle, and just absolutely went at it for about 4 minutes. And it intimidated me just watching it, being on the ice. But it was one of the best fights I've ever seen.
Shit, man. And people forget, like, and first of all, I want to, you know, finish that by saying he was great to me. He's real awesome. Amazing. And him and Shane Corson were on my team, and they really, I mean, Recky was there. Like, there was a lot of older guys, but like Mance always made sure.
One of the best teammates ever. One of the toughest.
One of the best guys, you know. And I remember, you know what else he told me? We used to go like bull in the ring kind of thing, like throw it in the corner one-on-one. And they would always have me go against guys like that, you know, to make me better like they should have. And I was like, how do you always know where I am? And he goes, I go in first and I can see you in the mirror. And he was talking about the glass. I was like, I never thought about that before. It never even crossed my mind to use the glass rink as a mirror.
Again, I think he learned that from Chelly as well, yes.
Probably, you know, because for every raw-faced kid like me coming along, he was like that at one point. But look, one of the years you played with him, I think it was 93, 94, or 92, 93, 79 games played, he had 54 points. That's a lot of points in any era for a defenseman. 352 minutes. I try to tell, but some of these characters are not talked about anymore, and we forget them, and there's some guys that go on, like Paul Bunyan and Davy Crockett, they're legends, but I'm like, this guy, people should remember how fucking tough and good he was.
He was he was one of the best all-around defensemen I ever played with. He could shoot the puck, he could fight, he could hit. He could make passes. He was a great first passer out of the zone coming around the net. He was intimidating in front of the net. He played the game. He played the position as well as anybody. There's no question. He played he played in Chicago in his first All-Star game with me in 91.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
In 91. So he was an All-Star defenseman. There's no question about it. And, you know, he got even more intimidating when he lost his voice with the shot, when he got hit with the shot in the throat.
That's how it happened. Yeah. I forgot. He told me he got hit. Yeah. I didn't know if it was an elbow or a...
And his son Josh, you know, was around as a young kid, and you knew he was going to grow up to be a lot like his dad. And he's turned out an awesome career himself.
Yeah, man. Yeah, there's something to that, right?
Well,
you
saw Josh Manson the other day in Colorado give Connor Bedard a slash into the wrist. That's Dave mentality. Right, true blue.
Complete. Now, think about, like, with people, I just want to remind people, this is as much a statement as anything. 93, 94, your top three scorers in Chicago, you, Joe Murphy, and Chelios, you got 125 PIMs. Murphy gets 111. Chelly, 212. I'm just like, that's how the game has changed. I know there was tough guys, and, you know, you came right through your area, and there was one, two, three guys on a team. A lot of them couldn't skate, but they could beat the shit right out. But there's other – people don't realize how tough the other players were. Yeah. The top three scorers, now 111, would almost lead the NHL. Yeah. And you had three guys who were, you know, two-way players.
I do have one stat I think that doesn't get recognized, and I don't think it'll get broken in the National Hockey League. I was in Phoenix. And I led the team in goals, assists, points, and penalty minutes in back-to-back seasons. So
I've never heard.
Yeah, it's quite a hard feat to do. It was quite hard back then, and it's almost impossible now.
Yeah, well, it's almost impossible now. You're right. Yeah, it was, and even back then, even though it was rougher, but there's still, I mean, overall, but still, someone had to fight, someone had to score, someone had to hit.
We know hockey games move fast, but with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NHL, you can score faster than anything happening on the ice. This week, new customers can bet $5 and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code THPN. New customers can bet $5 to get $200 instantly in bonus bets, only on DraftKings Sportsbook. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction, void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/hockey for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gambling resources. NHL and the NHL Shield are registered trademarks of the National Hockey League. Copyright NHL 2024, all rights reserved.
Now, I need to get to that part of it, JR. How did you... You fucking run, guys. That's one difference. At the best of it, I was never a great hitter. They said it on my hockey cards and stuff because they just assumed it because I had penalty minutes. But I would, like, finish on the boards. But you would run guys in open ice. And even if you look at your hits, like, a lot of them are still good today. Like, a lot aren't. And through no one's fault. I knew not to go on the railroad tracks with Scott Stevens. Everybody knew. And if he'd hit me and his elbow hit my hit, whatever. I just don't go there. But now they break it down. Yeah. But a lot of yours still would be. Now, where did you learn to hit? Was it playing prep school,
fear,
or was it once you fear went to the NHL?
Fear. I never, okay. I never hit a soul before I turned pro. Never hit, never a soul. But Mike Keenan, in my second preseason game, my first year, my first training camp, grabbed me by the throat, and literally threatened my professional hockey life that if I kept swinging by checks and not finishing checks, I would never play in the league as long as he was a coach.
Wow.
So
you changed your game at a drop of a hat.
I had to. Those are the things when you have to make a choice in life. Do you do things that you know you're going to be uncomfortable with and get comfortable with it? Or do you just say, screw it, and take your chances of making it someplace else? I made the decision to go along with it and use my speed because I was really fast. So I wasn't heavy. Yeah. But what I could do is I can use my speed to become my velocity and use that in terms of my, you know, with the weight that I didn't have. And I found that I enjoyed hitting. I enjoyed feeling somebody's chest sink into my shoulder and what it felt like. I enjoyed seeing the pain on their face after I hit them. I enjoyed listening to the fans cheer every time that I rock somebody. And it became part of my game. It became part of my intimidation factor towards defensemen. They didn't know whether I was going to crush them against the boards or whether I was going to score a big goal or whether I was just going to come in and grab the puck. There was always a question mark on somebody when I was on the ice with their head up because they had to be very aware of where I was because I wanted to hit. I wanted to hit often and I wanted to hit to hurt. There's no question. I don't mind saying that because that's how it was back then.
Yeah, and I mean, they're getting bonus miles out of you because they draft you knowing that you're talented, but when, you know, and speaking of that, and by the way, you're fast, but you're agile as well, and that's, I think that's the big part.
Yeah, you know,
right?
it was a bad thing. What I didn't realize is that when you do play like that, and back then when there's no instigator rule, you have to stand up and you have to stand up for the way that you play. And there were many, many times where I had to fight Bob Probert, I had to fight Marty McSorley, I had to fight Berube, I fought Kelly Chase, Darren Kimball. I fought all the tough guys because I had to. I had to show up because I played a certain way. And when you're called to the bell, because of how you play, you have to stand up or else you get no respect.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people forget that. Like, and that's, it wasn't an easy way to play back then. And you had every reason, really, you could have laid off. But right up to the end, JR, I'm not trying to suck your cock here. I guess I kind of am. But, I mean, that's the way it was. Now, you spoke about Mike Keenan. Now, I've heard, and everybody has, the worst about, but I met him, he seemed like a decent guy. You seem to respond. Sometimes to me, I'm like, you know, you either, you do it, or like when I first went out to junior at 14 and I wanted to go home and score 6 goals a game and get laid and get bloated with the boys, I just looked in the mirror and I said, fucking do it. Like, that's it. Yeah. I were left too, and I'm like, what am I going to do here, right? So the physical part was, it was a little different than you. It was, you know, 14, and it was as much trying to grow up and be accepted as anything. But in those times, I remember, there's been times and you just say, fuck it, I'm going to go with it. Now, Keenan, you could have folded, but you told me a little bit earlier when he sent you to junior, he sounded like a compassionate guy. He wasn't an idiot. He sounded logical. He was just real hard. Now, you responded well, because I've seen quotes. What was it about him that you liked or loved or whatever?
To me, he was honest. He didn't blow smoke up your ass. He told you when you were playing great, and he told you when you were playing bad. He was always there for support. If I was struggling, I could go into his office and talk to him. But he treated me like he treated everybody else. And some people didn't like the way Mike Keenan treated them, and they thought they should be treated different than other players. But Mike Keenan treated everybody the same. And it was all in or you're all out with Mike Keenan. There was no way. He wanted to be the toughest team in the league. He wanted to be the hardest team to play against in the league. And he wanted you to be multi-dynamic. He didn't like people to be one-dimensional. And if he yelled, nice. He yelled at you because he knew you had better in you. And if you didn't have better in you, he just didn't even bother with you. He just knew you weren't going to be part of the team or be a part of the culture. He didn't even bother. But when he yelled at you, it was for a reason. And I was used to that. I was used to coaches yelling from when I was, my dad is my coach, to my high school coach was a yeller. I didn't mind tough coaching because, you know, I responded well to it. Because I would always stand up and pound my chest and say, all right, fucker, if that's the way you want it, here we go. Let's go. I didn't sit back and whine and cry like, oh, he doesn't like me. I didn't care whether you liked me or not. I was there for your approval, not for your friendship.
Interesting. Are you aware of how good you were in the 93-94 Sega Genesis game? And how did that, or Sega hockey, and how did that happen? You're like the Bo Jackson cheat code. Are you aware, and did you know people at the company or some shit?
No, it was a surprise to me, and whatever happened. I heard there was a glitch in the game that they didn't even know that they did that made me the 99.9 player. And it was the only player in history that in all of, you know, gaming.
Yeah, you could score every time.
And that became it is my mantra. It is the most things that people talk about in the course of a day.
I was wondering if you've heard. Of course, you have. Well, but okay, I didn't realize
it is by far my biggest attribute of my professional hockey career is how famous I was in '94 Sega. And, you know, then I was watching, you know, Swingers and just watching Swingers. I didn't even know about it, and there I see Vince Vaughn saying my name on Swingers. It became part of pop culture, and then won an award for top gamers in gaming history. It was
unbelievable. Isn't Vince Vaughn from Chicago? I see him at Chicago game. I don't see him. I see him on TV.
He's from Chicago.
So you probably come across him.
He's from Chicago, and it just so happened that I saw him in a bar in 1998 after Swingers came out, and I went and I walked up to him and I just said, "Hey, you know, Vince, it's so cool that, you know, hi, you know, it's so cool you put me in Swingers with the video game." He goes, "Oh, dude, that's just all respect, man. I watched you play the game. I played the video game, and I put that in the movie just because I respect you so much." I said,
"Unfucking believable." Really cool. Now, speaking of that, Chicago is, I think, I don't know how, but it's underrated. Like, people talk New York, LA, but Chicago's right there, and there's so much to do. I love Chicago, especially
in
the summertime.
Chicago blows away LA. There's no question about that.
I know.
New York is big, but it's overwhelming. You can't really, you're it's the concrete jungle. Chicago it's beautiful, great restaurants. It's open. It's not as building congested. It's, you know,
Yeah.
Nicer people.
Good little music shops.
Right on the lake. Right on the lake. It's like you're living on the ocean.
Yeah. Beaches, right? Like people forget that. But what the reason I'm saying is because you're there and your heyday, you're with, and I mean, I don't know much about it, but you're on the scene with Michael Jordan, Dennis Rodman, Ron Harper, these guys, and they're in like their prime. I mean, there's Blackhawks and obviously there's more sports teams, but being the Cubs and
Cubs, White Sox, Bears, I mean,
the Wolves, White Sox. But I'm thinking you're there with Jordan and those guys. Did you really get to know them, or did you just see them once in a while?
We saw them. I mean, Chelios became best friends with Jordan back in the 91, 92, 93 when Chelly got there.
Wow.
And they still remain best of friends. Chelly and I used to go out with Rodman and Ronnie Harper all the time. And I mean, God forbid, God save Chicago when we all went out after games. But we were there watching the championships. You know, we were there watching championships. And, you know, we wanted to win one, too. I mean, the early 90s when Bulls were winning championships, we went to the finals in 92. We had great teams. It was a good time to be in Chicago. There's no question about it.
Fucking rights, man. That must have been. And, I mean, I'm guessing all the sports guys, you would have golfed with Jordan. And I don't know if Rodman ever golfed. Yeah, I know he's big on it, Jordan.
No golf.
You go on. I'm wondering this. You lost to Pittsburgh in the finals, right? Am I wrong
on
that? You lost.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. And the legend that is Mario Lemieux is almost bigger than the game at this point. So a lot of people forget that. Now, to get to the finals must have been a hard fucking deal, especially when you first came in.
It was. Well, it was. You know, but it wasn't at that time. We rattled off 11 straight in the playoffs that year. We won 11 straight games going into the finals, and Pittsburgh had rattled seven off going into the finals.
They
beat us four straight, but we were on a roll. I mean, we crushed St. Louis, we crushed Detroit, they crushed Edmonton, and we just ran right through the finals. I think we were down 2-1 to St. Louis in the first round, and then we didn't lose again all the way until we met Pittsburgh in game one of the finals. And we were up 4-1. We're up 4-1 in game one of the Stanley Cup finals. And Jaromir Jagr in the second period scored one of the most beautiful goals I've ever seen, ever.
Yeah, I know,
and
I know that
undressed
goal.
Our entire line on the team twice, scored a big
the
goal.
Backhander.
And that's the first time that we all looked at each other and like, oh, shit, we're in trouble. And Mario scored the winner with like 2 minutes left in the game. And he threw the puck at the back of Eddie's leg from behind the net and just hit like a four by four inch hole to win the game at the end of the game. And then we couldn't rebound from there. We lost four straight, all by one goal.
I know you only have a couple of minutes here, so I'm just going to get to a couple more questions. Or do you need to take off right now?
I got a couple more minutes for sure.
Okay. So I need to, because I mean, big time hitting Hatcher. Didn't Ludwig hurt your wrist like right before the Hatcher? And it was because you hit Modano, right?
Yeah, I knocked Modano off
the base. I don't want to.
Knocked Modano off the night before. It was a home at home, Phoenix, Dallas. First period, I'm going around the net. Craig Ludwig slashes my finger, breaks my thumb, and a second half later, Hatcher hits me with his elbow, breaks my jaw in six places, and ends up getting a 5-minute penalty and a game misconduct. I go to the bench. I'm pulling my jaw out of my mouth, bleeding everywhere. And the lady in the front row goes down. She sees it, passes out. And I wouldn't leave the bench. We had a 5-on-3 power play, and I wouldn't leave the game because I wanted so bad to go out and score a goal because everybody was going crazy after I got hit. I was getting yelled at from everybody. I knew it was coming. But I wanted to score a goal in that 5-on-3, so all I could do is just leave the ice, you know, giving everybody the bird as I was going off the ice to get the last lap. I didn't score, but still – the fact that I played for 5 more minutes with my jaw flopping all over the place was pretty bad.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. So, I mean, I know you came back the next season. Like,
no, I came back, that looked to me I like came back 16 days later in game 7 of the first round against St. Louis. Yeah.
You came back 16 days after that happened. That's almost unbelievable. And I know a couple of times you came back against St. Louis when you were with Chicago too and scored. If I don't, I know you talked about it a little bit and we're bringing up the same story, but I just want to get this clear because that was a big instance. That was a big incident that happened. You come back 16 days later. When did your face heal? Like in the summer, you went to camp and everything. It looked like something that, you know, might end a career.
Yeah, no, I was wired up for 10 weeks after we lost 1-0 in game 7 to St. Louis. And I was wired shut for about 8 to 10 weeks into the summer after that. So, and listen, that didn't matter whether I broke my jaw in that game or not, because I had the whole summer to heal. But, you know, it was more important to try to win that game and get to the second round for our team than it was for my face to be, you know.
Jer, of course, you're the ultimate fucking teammate. That doesn't surprise me one bit. Now, how is it like, because you came up with Medano all that time. And, you know, you guys have been, you must have been teammates on USA. Yeah. Although I don't remember you being at the 96 World Cup. What happened there?
That was the year that I got traded from the Hawks, and I got traded because of a contract dispute. I was getting ready to go to Phoenix, and I was negotiating a contract with them, and we were about $1 million off of our, and I hadn't signed yet Phoenix. And my agent just, being the smart person he was, like, listen, you know, we just left Chicago because they wouldn't give you the money that you're looking for. We're trying to get the money that you're looking for in Phoenix. I wanted $4 million a year at that time, and 96 was a lot of money. And that I'm coming off like my heyday. If I go to the World Junior, I mean the World Champion or the World Cup, and if I get hurt at the World Cup, what happens? So it was all a really just
totally.
It was all a protection. I didn't have a contract. I didn't have a team. I had to make a decision because I love USA Hockey so much, and I love that team, the World Cup team, and I wish I was a part of that. But even looking back today, even knowing that they won that big championship, I would not have changed my position because I did it literally to protect my earning career and the contract that I was trying to sign. If I get hurt in the World Cup, I don't sign that contract, and I'm out $20 million.
100%. Do you and Medano ever cross paths now?
Yeah, every once in a while. A lot of golfers. We play a lot of golf together at the same tournaments, and you know we're friends. We've been friends for a long time, but you know we've also been very very harsh opponents of each other because he was the best American hockey player. I still think he's the best American hockey player ever. Which he might be dethroned by either Patrick Kane or maybe Austin Matthews or whatever. You could throw Chelly in there. But in terms of grace, talent, goal scoring ability, the way that he played the game, Mike Medano to me was the best. So I always, always tried to take advantage of him because it was the only way that I could beat him. And if I could beat him, then I knew I had the upper hand on him. That's just a respect.
Hey, that's what a competitive, passionate person does. And I'm glad that you guys respect each other and can bury the fucking hatchet. That's great. And that is hockey. And we're back. We're on YouTube. Have a look right now. I'm sitting with my kitty, Princess. Princess, say hi. Say hi, Princess. She normally talks. Say hi. We come a long way. She started with meow. Now she can say her name. Say Princess Ryan. She's being difficult. Anyway, Princess just unhooked. Well, she stepped on the cord that connects the computer to the wall. So I lost my JR interview, even though it was almost over. He only had like 2 or 3 more minutes. But Princess, my cat Princess, just put the kibosh on my Jeremy Roenick interview, one of my favorite people and hockey players of all time. Anyway, I will be in Brooks, Alberta tomorrow. Just 1 second. My mom is calling. Okay. I don't even remember where I left that. A lot has happened since I picked up this mic last. As you know, my cat hit the cord, which led to the computer. I think it was just knocked ajar. The battery should be fine. But whatever Princess did, she knocked the computer off, and I was knocked offline, okay? So there's that. When I looked down after being knocked off, the phone was ringing, and it was my mom. And she says, Penny, because I had Penny Lane at basketball practice tonight. She had soccer, then basketball. So I dropped her to soccer, And I said to my parents, you know, pick him up. Soccer's over at 8 o'clock. Can you go off or basketball? Can you pick her up? Now, mom calls. It's 8:28. She goes, yeah, she wasn't there. And then I'm thinking, oh, it must have been 8:30. Sure enough, Penny Lane calls while I'm on the phone with mom. I'm here. Where are you? Right? And I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, and it was senior too. It wasn't mom. Well, I told my mom, but senior went up there. And for someone with 5 degrees and reads so much and is so smart about history, and he really is, like, he's, in some ways, you're jaw dropped just listening to him. But when it comes to common sense, I can't explain it. When it comes to common sense, I'm like, why didn't he just like make sure? If it's not 8 and you're wondering what's happening and there's cars there and the lights on in the gym, what do you think? Obviously, it went a little late, or it went till 8:30 or 8:15 or whenever. You know, you look into that. Same thing. We go, how much time has how many times has this guy traveled? I don't know. I mean, he played fucking pro hockey. I mean, he coached junior teams. They had to travel. I mean, you know, we've been all over. You see me traveling with him to Spit and Chicklets events, to Toronto, whatever it is. I mean, the guy travels a couple of times a year anyway. I mean, in his heyday, probably 30 times, more than that, a year. And yet every time we go through security, it's like the first time. Oh, I got to take off my cowboy boots. Yeah, just like you did last time and the time before that and the time before that and the 50 times before that. Oh, I got to take the change out of my pocket. What should I do here, Terry? Should I take off my belt? Do I need to? Yeah, it's pretty much the fucking same wherever we go, right? We're mostly traveling here in Canada and the United States. And I don't know, at least since 2001, the rules have been pretty much the same across the board, senior. Holy fuck. We were coming back from Rome one year. I took him to Rome, Italy with my buddy Francis Mooney. And I don't know where we went from Rome to London to here, London, England. So we, I don't remember which airport, but I remember we're going through and he talks to everybody, right? And not everybody wants to fucking talk. And this person is at customs, and I don't know, again, in one of those airports overseas. We want to come back. I think we're going to Toronto and then Newfoundland. We got a long way ahead of us, right? Like a long way. We're going to get home in like 20 hours or a day from the point that we're standing there. Anyway, he starts talking. Oh, yeah. Where are you from? Oh, sounds like you're from the United States. No, sir. I'm from, you know, wherever, Britain. I lived in the United States for 3. Oh, really? Oh, and what are you doing? Sir, can you turn around? Sir, do you have any? And they were really, sir, we need to check your bag. We need to stand. And he's still talking. And then they said, okay, we got to give your bag a second check, as they do, like with lots of bags, right? Clearly, we're not transporting drugs. You know, we went over for a trip. I don't know. We had beers over there and might have smoked a joint, but there was nothing other than that, and there's no reason for him to even speak about it. So then he says, we'd never carry drugs. He goes, I'm not carrying drugs. Oh, no. And then they asked him, and what do you say about drugs, sir? No drugs, no bombs, nothing like that. Wait. And right away, and Mooney goes, you fucking moron. Now, we're fucking flagged, right? Yet, I shouldn't say moron. It was probably, I don't know if Mooney, but Mooney definitely did say that. Yeah, for sure. Anyway, but yet, while we're waiting, like, he'll tell you the statistics of New Zealand in 1942 playoffs in the NHL, or tell you, like, Julius Caesar's height, weight, victory battles, who was leader of, who was the consul during his time, who were the leaders of Rome at any particular year, or doesn't have to be Rome. I could say, fucking name me one thing about Napoleon Bonaparte, say, and he'll tell me the entire fucking history, not only what you see in the movie. He'll tell me, like, what he was into as a kid. His height and weight is obvious, like, for him. What kind of sword he used, what were his battle tactics, and then I could say, tell me a little bit about René Descartes, a philosopher, I don't know, in like the year 1200, and he'll tell me all his writings, his opinions. He'll tell me who was Pope at the time. It's fucking wild, and he'll do that with just about anything. And it doesn't have to be like historical monarchs or battle-tested soldiers or generals or stuff like that. It can be the Wild West. He'll tell me where Billy the Kid, it just came up the other day in the car. And he's like, oh yeah, Billy the Kid. And went on to tell me where he was from. I forget his real name now. I do know it, but I forget. It's escaping me. And he'll tell me that, where he was from, how many people he shot, when he came across Wyatt Earp, which towns they were in. It's fucking amazing. And yet, oh, she's in that building. That's her school. The gymnasium light is on. There's cars parked. So there's people in there. But she's not out of here at 8:02, so she must not be here. Right? Anyway, that happened. And when I was backing out, so when Penny Lane called, I said, oh, my God, I'll be right there. So I put this on pause, backed up, hit the fucking garbage can. It's garbage day tomorrow. And I had my stuff out there. I hit that, drove it out into the road, garbage all over the road. Fucking the dog from across the street came over as the, because now the bags were a little ripped as it was. Dog's coming over going mad. Nice dog, but there's food out in the street and garbage or whatever. So that was a whole ordeal. I pulled that in. Two of the neighbors from the other side come over. Is everything all right? We heard you hit something. Yes, it's the garbage, whatever. Penny Lane's still waiting. I got to take off. Sorry, guys. Anyway, I went to get Penny Lane, and we stopped by. I got her a milkshake and some nuggets, and now here I am. So a lot has taken place. Anyway, so apologies for the Roenick interview cutting short a little bit early, but we'll have him on again. And he's a great, and I knew he had to go anyway. Like we only had a few minutes there. So thank you, JR. And thank you guys for listening. And for you Beatles fans that wanted on episode 195A that wanted to hear about my favorite albums and whatnot, we'll have to wait till next time. But next week we'll have another great guest. I got some awesome guests coming. I appreciate all you guys listening and staying faithful. And I appreciate Jeremy Roenick coming on today. And what I can do for you is give you some recommendations. If you come to St. John's, why don't you check out Trinity Pub? Awesome spot. Check out TJ's. Used to be Turkey Joe's, the old hockey hangout. Check out Rob Roy, Rob Roy Confusion, Kevin English's bar, Carl English's brother, the best basketball player to ever come from the island. And Kevin was great in his own right. Good friend of mine. Greensleeves, of course. Live music, awesome food, good times, good fun. Martini Bar, Pete Quinton, another great dude, brought in Alanis Morissette last year, and looking to bring somebody else in this year. Awesome dude. Bull and Barrel, Tino Borges and company. Those are the places that I would go for a beer. And George Street's awesome. Downtown St. John's is awesome. Those are just my favorite spots, watering holes. Now, if I was going to get a bite to eat, I'd go to Loose Tie for sure. That's above Greensleeve, same building, and really new and improved. Not new, but it's improved. It was always pretty good, but the fucking food there now is out of this world, and the ambiance is to die for. The ambiance is to die for. That doesn't sound right. The ambiance is tranquil. There you go. And that's a positive vibe. If I was going to go outside of that, I'd go just down the street to Merchant Tavern and Blue on Water. If I was in the east end of St. John's, I would definitely go to Wedgwood Cafe. They also do catering. Peter Wedgwood at Wedgwood Cafe. If I wanted to change my attitude and start working out, I'd call Ryan Power of Power Conditioning on Rope Walk Lane. Strength and balance for the body and mind. And a great environment. Ryan's a great guy, ex-pro hockey player. Speaking of hockey players, great dudes. Chris Sparks at Mr. Lube. There's two locations in St. John's. One's on Torbay Road. The other is on Kenmount Road. Live, laugh, lube! And, of course, Pitbull Pain Relief, the pain sticks that just don't quit. Go to pitbullpainrelief.com. See what all the fuss is about. True Hockey, take what's yours. Folks, I'll be back in just a couple of days with more Tales with Tierra tomorrow night. Or tonight, I guess. Jason Greger, The Greg Greger Show. Mondays and Thursdays, I co-host. I love doing it. And I love Alberta. I'll be there this weekend. So shout out to my buddies in Edmonton that listen to the Jason Greger podcast and all over the world, I guess. Takes place out of Edmonton. And my buddies in Calgary and by extension Brooks, Alberta. I will be there this weekend. We're going to raise some money for the Brooks Bombers baseball squad. We're going to have a lot of fun doing it. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you guys on the rebound.